Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an historical perspective on how wars in the past, like the Civil War, which ended slavery, and World War II, which brought about a social safety net, have enhanced American democracy, whereas since 9/11 and the War on Terror, our freedom at home has been restricted and we no longer defend democracy abroad, but threaten it. Jeremy Suri, Professor of History and Public Affairs at the University of Texas, joins us to discuss his new book, The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office, and his article at The Washington Post, How 9/11 Triggered Democracy's Decline. We will look into why the U.S. no longer wins wars and why we are fighting wars against our own democracy. Then we will speak with Mona Crevel, a professor of government at Cornell University, who is a fellow of the Mannheim Center for European Research at the University of Mannheim in Germany. She joins us to discuss German Chancellor Merkel's offer to participate in future nuclear talks with North Korea and her talks with Russia's President Putin, with whom she shares a growing alarm that Donald Trump is escalating the nuclear crisis with the equally unpredictable Kim Jong-un. Then finally, we'll examine the new round of sanctions on North Korea following a unanimous vote by the UN Security Council, and speak with Sung Yoon Lee, a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School at Tufts University, who has an article at the New York Times, The Way to Make North Korea Back Down, and another at the Los Angeles Times, Why Won't the U.S. Use Its Full Sanction Power Against North Korea? We will discuss China's dilemma of not wanting to create a failed state on its border at the same time as not wanting Kim's provocations to cause more U.S., South Korean, and military power being introduced into the neighborhood. And joining us now is Jeremy Suri, who's a professor of history and public affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He's just published a new book, The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office. And he has an article at the Washington Post, How 9/11 Triggered Democracy's Decline. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeremy Suri.
Thank you for having me on, Ian.
And Jeremy, let's start with your article in the Washington Post on how 9/11 triggered democracy's decline. You make the point that America's previous wars have actually improved and built upon American democracy. The Civil War, of course, abolished slavery, and World War II promoted welfare rights, a social safety net, decent employment, higher education. And arguably, as a result of that, we had a kind of a social democracy in the United States from about 1944 to 1977. But you also point out that over the last 16 years, since 9/11, American freedoms have been diminished by this, what was called the War on Terror. But I don't know what they call it now, but let's face it, we have spending more today on defense than we did at the height of the Cold War, when we had a real enemy who could destroy the United States. In 30 minutes, every American city was targeted on a hair trigger by the Soviet Union. And here we are spending more money on a group of ragtag jihadis running around the deserts of the Middle East in pickup trucks, who basically are being rounded up and killed as we speak. So it's an odd situation, isn't it, in the broader sweep of history?
Yes. I think you've summarized some very important historical points that are very relevant to the world we live in today. I'm not advocating war in any sense, and war has been a tragedy throughout American history. Millions of Americans have died in various wars. 500,000 die in the Civil War alone. But the wars Americans have generally fought have resulted after the wars with an expansion in freedom for many groups that were denied freedom before the war. So the freeing of slaves, as you said, after the Civil War, the movement towards civil rights and greater gender equality and more social welfare rights in the United States after World War II. And this happened in these wars, Ian, not because the United States spent more or less money, but because the United States demanded the collective sacrifice of all citizens. And in return for their sacrifice on the battlefield, they were promised more freedom. This war, since September 11th, 2001, whatever we call it, has been a war where we have been afraid to ask Americans to sacrifice sacrifice. We've tried to fight the war while Americans shop, and we've tried to, in a sense, hire a constabulary army to fight for us. And as a consequence, we haven't made promises of expanding freedom. In fact, we've done the opposite. So this is the first war in American history where we have become less free the more we have fought it. And it's been a war that is actually not about freedom anymore. It's about power and dominance. And this departs, I argue, from the main strains of American history. And it's one of the reasons we're in such a terrible situation in our democracy at home today.
Well, the other question, though, is that we don't win wars anymore, not since World War II, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, and every of the post-Cold War war we've been involved in, particularly Afghanistan and Iraq. The only winner of the Iraq War are clearly the Iranians, and the Afghanistan is our longest war with no end in sight, and we're not making any progress there. So something's happened in that regard, that we're not expected to win wars anymore, or it doesn't seem to count. But as a result of the Vietnam War, which was clearly contentious and which we clearly lost, they got rid of the draft. And that, I think, has led to this dissociation between the American people and their own military, which I don't think is very healthy. Not that I'm saying we should have a draft, but maybe we should reinstate the notion of national service, where you don't have to just go into the military. You can take care of the homeless or become a nurse or an environmentalist. But, of course, that is something that's an anathema to conservatives, because that's big government, is it not?
Yes, yes. I have come to agree with you, Ian, that a draft would be a good thing. And by the way, many of the most distinguished military figures in American society today, including General McChrystal, have supported this argument as well. A draft would provide at least some basis for all citizens across classes and races to serve the public and to develop a notion of public service. But your other point, I think, is even more important. The United States has not won a war. It has not been successful militarily, really, on the scale it claims to be since World War II. And we've been lying to ourselves for a long time. We keep saying that we never lose wars. That's what President Trump said in his speech about Afghanistan, that we always win. That's actually not true. We've become so large and so powerful that we can fight a lot of losing wars and still go on and pretend that we're winning. We're sort of like that football team that loses but has enough supporters that everyone just continues to think they're a great team even when they're losing all their games. And the reason we're not doing well is because we're fighting the wrong wars in the wrong places, and we're fighting the wrong way. We're fighting without full citizen engagement. We should fight few wars, and when we fight, the entire population should be involved and behind it. That's how we win wars, and that's how we make sure our wars serve the idealistic purposes, the democratic purposes that our society should be about.
Well, you know, George Orwell in 1984 posited, you know, and that was clearly an analogy for the, or in some ways, a reflection of the Cold War between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, that in effect the Soviet Union and the United States waged war on their own people, because there was no possibility of a war, really, and they essentially diverted all their resources into the Russian military-industrial complex and the American military-industrial complex. And that gets back to my question, which is a real puzzlement, is how come we have spending more on defense today and our enemy is being rounded up and they're just a bunch of hapless jihadis, very small in number to begin with, and now, of course, their number is being reduced dramatically. So what's your explanation for that?
Well, I think there are three things that explain why, as you so correctly say, we are spending so much more money on defense than, well, let's put it this way, we spend much more money on defense than we spend on infrastructure, education, and things that matter so much more for our society right now. So why do we spend this money on defense? I think there are three things at work. It is a very complicated world, and even though we don't have an adversary like the Soviet Union, there are a wide range of adversaries. So it's actually more expensive to try to cover the global range of adversaries we confront. But that might be because we're trying to do too much. We've become an empire, and we're trying to provide security for ourselves against all kinds of different actors in different regions, and that's costing us a lot of money. That's one problem. Second, and this was implied in your question, there are many organized interests in the United States, what Dwight Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex. They're not conspirators, but they benefit from this world. They benefit from the purchase of aircraft. They benefit from the purchase of military materials. The state of Texas, where I live, the U.S. military is one of the largest employers. Federal contractors that serve the military are some of the largest employers. So there's a corporate welfare story that's going on. I always tell people, Ian, the United States is a welfare state. It's just sometimes the welfare goes to the businesses, not to the citizens. That's the problem. The third reason we have this big defense spending in place is because it's politically and symbolically powerful to say, I'm increasing defense spending. Maybe everyone thinks you're being strong. And so it's a symbolic way, even though you're not winning wars, of showing that you're tough. And so Donald Trump has promised to increase defense spending even more, even though he hasn't told us what he's going to use it for. But that's supposed to make us think he's tough and we're strong. It's like going to the gym. We're going to the gym some more. We're going to be a stronger country. We're going to spend more money on defense. So we're spending too much money in the wrong places, and we need to reevaluate these things. And we did that after every other war. We have been unable to do that in our society today.
And again, I'm speaking with Jeremy Suri, a professor of history and public affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He's just published a new book, The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office. And he has an article at the Washington Post, How 9/11 Triggered Democracy's Decline. Let's talk a little about your new book, The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office. You make the case that essentially our presidents have become managers of the world's largest economy and the military, as we've just talked about, and they have to react to everything that's happening 24/7 around the globe. We recall the 3 a.m. phone call in the presidential campaigns, the idea that anything could happen at any moment. And of course, in this globalized world with 24-hour news cycles, particularly with a president like Donald Trump who watches television all the time, it is a constant, you're constantly whipsawed, so you're more of a manager than a visionary by definition. Is that the case?
Yes. So my book makes the argument that the problem with the presidency today is not just the person in office, that is part of the problem, but that it's a longer historical trajectory. This office was created, as I describe early in the book, as a small office designed actually not to be a managerial office in any way, nor to be an office that dominated the country, but to be a leadership office that offered a strategic vision and helped to unify the country. And that's why George Washington didn't join any party. He was supposed to be above party. He was supposed to play a unifying, forward-looking role. And our great presidents for the first 150 years did that. They amassed more power in doing that, but they used their power to bring the country forward and to bring the country together. What's happened since World War II is because our country has become so large, so complex, with so many interest groups, and our demands and interests have become so global, the president has become less a forward thinker, less a leader, less a unifier, and more someone who tries to provide goodies to different groups and appease different actors rather than serving the broader national interests of the country. And if you look at the way presidents spend their time, and I show this in the book, they spend more and more time with each successive generation since World War II on things that are not serving the interests of the country as a whole.
Just elaborate on that, if you will.
So they end up spending a lot of time, presidents do, reacting to crises. So let's take just what you were asking about before, Ian. Since the early 1970s, terrorism has preoccupied presidents of the United States, and every administration from Richard Nixon's through to the present has spent more time reacting to terrorist incidents. Now, terrorist incidents are terrible, but there has never yet really been a terrorist incident that threatened the future of the United States. Even September 11th was really not threatening to bring the collapse of the United States. Presidents have spent inordinate time chasing small numbers of terrorists around the world and not dealing with issues like the environment, issues like the future sustenance of the American economy, issues like the education of citizens. So we've diverted our resources to the smaller actors. Presidents react to crises and react to demands rather than putting together a strategy that helps advance the country, which is what their predecessors did before World War II.
Well, of course, the purpose of terrorism is to get people to react. I mean, obviously, yes. The best thing we could do about terrorism would be to ignore it. But yes. I guess we don't have the maturity, and a president who tried to ignore terrorism would be pilloried, right?
Well, I don't know. I would like to see a president try to do that. And ignoring is not completely neglecting it. But one could do things to try to contain the problem and certainly to educate the American public that this is not something that should be dominating the way we think. Let me be even more explicit about this. One of the greatest benefits to American society in the last 200 years has been the arrival of immigrants, talented immigrants, to our society. I'm the child of immigrants to the United States. If we allow our fear of terrorism to bring us to build walls and keep talented immigrants out, as we're doing now, we are undermining our national interests. We are making our society much weaker. We're allowing the terrorists to win. A president should be saying what I just said. That's a broader strategic goal. That's a view of the country as a whole. That's a unifying vision of an inclusive country. That's exactly what Franklin Roosevelt was arguing for during World War II. But we haven't had leaders who do that because leaders are incentivized instead to provide raw meat to various angry groups in the electorate and angry donors rather than the larger interests of the country. And that's what's made the presidency impossible, as I describe it.
But do you think, though, it's inherently impossible because under our system, the president is both the head of state and the political leader? And when you say that earlier presidents, starting with George Washington, were able to unify the country and be more symbolic as leaders and less political, and in Washington's case, he didn't even want to belong to a political party.
Correct.
Is that the problem, that you've got these two roles that aren't necessarily compatible?
Ian, that is one of the core themes of my book. The founding fathers actually didn't know what the presidency was going to look like, and they didn't agree. But they benefited from the fact that the office was small, the country was small, the responsibilities were small. And so, in a sense, the president could have multiple jobs at the same time, as you said. Head of state, like a king or queen, visiting with diplomats, unifying the country, also being a commander-in-chief, also being, in a sense, a prime minister with legislative agendas. And the president could do all those things. But as the country has become bigger and bigger, and my point in the book is that scale matters, as the responsibilities have grown, it's become inhuman. We suffer from gigantism. We are too big to succeed. And one single man cannot, or one single woman cannot do this job. I try to show that in great detail in the last few chapters, how very talented people like John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson struggled and failed. Even Ronald Reagan, who some sees as a success. There are so many failures because the office overwhelmed him. We need to think about this. As a country of the size we are, with the global reach we have, with the demands upon power, we're not set up in the executive office. And blowing up the system, as Donald Trump promises to do, is only going to make this worse.
Well, I mentioned earlier the conservative mantra about big government being the problem, which certainly was something that Ronald Reagan introduced. But my sense is that big money is the problem. And, you know, for example, when just before Senator Kennedy retired, and Ted Kennedy, he'd been in the Senate for a long, long time, he was asked in an interview, what's the biggest change you noticed in all your decades in the U.S. Senate? And he said, the biggest change is that we don't work anymore. We only come in on Tuesdays, work on Wednesdays, and then go back to the district on Thursday to raise money. And we raise money all over the weekends. And that's our routine. And that's the same with the House. Our members in the House are essentially telemarketers. They spend hours every day on the phone asking for money. So we've created a system where, in effect, plutocrats and big donors can buy the government, as the Koch brothers and Robert Mercer, who's pretty much bought the Trump administration, and the Koch brothers pretty much bought the Congress. That's the system we have. And my sense is that oligarchs and powerful donors, their attitude towards their political hirelings is an attitude of contempt, that they don't want to have talented people in there. They just want to have loyal functionaries who will do their bidding. And that's why Stephen Bannon is now helping elect Tea Party candidates, because they are the most loyal, if not the most, you know, insane. So how does that fit into your thesis, the idea that we have become, I think the Greeks call it timocracy, a rule by money?
Well, I think it's directly connected to what I'm talking about, which is, as power becomes centralized, it's easier for a few powerful actors to dominate power. The wisdom of the founders was that a federalist system, a system of divided authority, and I don't just mean between branches of government at the national level, but across state and local government, would make it harder, Madison claimed, for a particular interest to dominate. There would be more space for diversity, more space for different interests. And I think that would be the case today. It's not just that there are wealthy people who are trying to control the system. That's always been the case. The Rockefeller family tried in the late 19th century to control the political system. It's that right now, with gerrymandering and with the way that our parties are set up around fundraising, things are so centralized, and the presidency itself is such a centralized office now, that it's very easy for donors to do this. And a more decentralized system, devolving authority to different units, as the founders intended, would actually help us preserve democracy, it seems to me. Second point I would make along these lines is that one of the biggest problems we have in terms of representation is that we're putting people into office with expectations that are also unrealistic. And I think we as a society have to ask ourselves, what are the kinds of leaders we want? And we have to all get involved and participate. It's not just that moneyed interests are dominating our politics, it's that so many other interests are sitting out. This last election, the problem was the number of people who didn't vote, not the number of people who did vote. And you cannot blame the moneyed interests for that. That's a problem of citizen participation, which has to change. I argue in my book, we look too often for a savior so we can just go about our lives and our business rather than getting involved. The founders envisioned a much more participatory society than what we have become.
Well, indeed, we do think that every 4 years we elect a man on a white horse, and we've yet to elect a woman on a white horse, and they're going to solve all of our problems. And I think that was very much the case with Barack Obama. There was great expectation that he would be the miracle worker, and of course Obama's mantra was, yes, we can, not yes, I can. But yes, I can became our expectation, and people were disappointed in him. So you can't win. I thank you for joining us. I appreciate the conversation.
Thank you for having me on and for such excellent questions. That was a wonderful discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Jeremy Suri, Professor of History and Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He's just published a new book, The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office. And he has an article at the Washington Post, How 9/11 Triggered Democracy's Decline. We're going to take a brief station break and back discussing German Chancellor Merkel's talks with Russia's President Putin, with whom she shares a growing alarm that Donald Trump is escalating the nuclear crisis with North Korea's equally unpredictable Kim Jong-un.